attempt at 1013 in the vicinity of Canal and Broadway. Vehicles nearby, call in. Suspect is on foot heading south.
Dispatch, this is 1X-Ray 1 responding to that 1013. We're en route.
So like I was saying...
Copy that, 1X-Ray 1.
Put on your seatbelt.
The image of police has changed so much in the last 25, 30 years. There are so many reputations. At our best, we're meant to be protectors, right? We're the B cops who are just as much part of a neighborhood as the corner store. And we help detectives, generating leads. Sometimes we interview witnesses and people of interest. When I was a kid, it was always about being the good guy. That sunk in. What's the word?
I don't know what you're asking me.
Proactive. Like to work at being one of the good guys. It feels like that's less and less important to some.
And then we have this generation of sh-birds always on their phones.
Seriously, half of all the cops I see on the street are on their phone. What are they, fighting online piracy? Sorry, edit that out. We shouldn't talk like that. Okay, you want a story? We had a rough experience my first year.
Ugh.
She doesn't like this story. We had just been paired up. We were on subway patrols when we responded to a 1034. An assault called in by the conductor. Someone pulled the emergency cord while the train was coming into the station, so the train's got half its ass still in the tunnel. We got there before the doors were opened, and the conductor in the motor car had locked himself in. Guy looked terrified. Through his little window, he told us a passenger in A car went ape and attacked him, and he's scaring the shit out of the other passengers.
Get out of the intersection! Move that piece of shit!
1X-Ray 1, that 1013 is now at Broadway and Leonard Street, heading south.
This is 1X-Ray 1, copy that.
Through the window, all we can see are maybe 10 passengers spread out, all with their heads down, crying. We can't see the perp. I'm towards the last door, and my partner is at the front of the car, and we give the conductor the signal to open the doors. A few steps in, I didn't even see the guy, but he pounced on Officer Larder and knocked her back onto the platform. But the guy doesn't stand up. He goes from bent over my partner on all fours, hissing at me, to running off onto the tracks and down the tunnel. My partner shouts at me that she'll call it in and that I should pursue. So I pursue the suspect into the tunnel. If I had thought about it, there's no way in hell I would have gone. But there I was, a rookie, pursuing this weirdo into the darkness. I at least knew with the train stuck in the station, I wasn't going to get run over. About 40 yards in, I lose the guy around the bend. That far in, the only lights still on are the blue lights by the emergency boxes. I couldn't see him, but I could hear his footsteps, and then nothing. So, understandably, I'm cautious. He could jump out from anywhere. And I can't tell you why, but it smelled like rotten eggs, like a warm, smelly breeze going by. I keep going, and I see there's garbage on fire. Like scraps of newspaper floating around on fire. That's when I hear Larder calling me back. I turn around to leave, and down the tunnel, I'm looking at the blue emergency lights again. Just next to them, I see two red eyes. I thought they were eyes. With the burning paper floating in the air, it looked like two still glowing red eyes. When I got closer, they were gone. Anyway, it couldn't have been. If there were eyes where I saw them, it would have been like 8 feet in the air. But nothing. Weird night.
I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre.
Welcome back, listeners, to this new year.
Yeah.
It'll be the second episode of this new year.
Yeah.
But all the same, pretty excited. This is an episode I wasn't sure what it was until I started stripping away all the stuff that it wasn't.
Right. At first, I got a little worried. I was like,
Yeah, I don't know. I think, actually, until my later adulthood, I was a pretty big fan of the Cops.
I liked to watch the Cops TV show.
The actual Cop, not just The Wire, but actual. Like, you grew up watching Cops.
Oh, I still watch Cops. If I'm fixing dinner, I put Cops on.
That
one day I'll see my uncle on there. One day.
So yeah, I kind of saw my, I don't know, I think as a young kid, I was a very serious little kid, and I kind of had very black and white ideas of right and wrong, and I guess being a cop is just kind of like having the authority to make that call on society, like, that's bad, that's good, like, I don't know what drew me to it. I was a little fascist is what I'm saying. I was a little Taekwondo fascist when I was a kid.
Dude, I mean, I think about it now, especially when I watch things like The Wire, and I'm like, man, I should have been a cop, but then I think... No, that would have been terrible. Because with all that power comes great responsibility.
And we've talked about this at great length in terms of like what kind of cop we would be.
Yeah.
And so in the opening sketch, I mean, I guess it's a little bit of a nod towards those conversations as far as like you being the like no shit taking, I'm tired of this kind of.
I'm the Danny Glover.
You're too old for this shit. That's, the younger of the two of us is too old for this shit. But yeah, I don't know. In that opening, I kind of figured where officers, like, I don't know. I think maybe my officer has ambitions of taking the detective's exam.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think you got knocked back for like police brutality.
I'm like Herc.
Point.
Yeah, fair. And you're the one who like sold us all out. So you're Carver.
I no.
And that's how you got
still
your stripes.
Be working together. I mean,
Herc and Carver still work together. It's just Herc didn't know.
There's yeah, but all right.
Because you're well, shady. That's what I'm saying.
I'm the shady one. So for this episode, I started putting together the list of, like, police-related horror stories, and not just, like, the peripheral, like, Last House on the Left. Wes Craven has a tendency to write dumb cops.
He loves his bumbling cops. That's his thing. Actually, you know what kind of comes from? It comes from, there's a historical and historical reference to where Wes Craven gets that, or where Western culture gets that idea from our detectives in our modern kind of detective
really,
stories.
Really, there's like a point we can look back towards.
There was a guy who was a fan of Dickens. His name is Wilkie Collins. He lived in the Romantic era, so mid-1800s is when he was predominantly writing. And Wilkie had kind of established the set formula of what to expect of your detective stories.
In the mid-1800s.
Okay. Yeah, and what he had, number one, it was kind of like he was like a version of Shyamalan because all of his stories had something with this. And things you had to look out for was usually a house robbery.
Okay.
An inside job. There were going to be multiple red herrings in the story.
Ah, okay. That kinda...
There's going to be a skilled investigator, but a bungling local constable. That's part of it. A large number of red herring false suspects. It's always going to be the least likely suspect. And at the end, there's always going to be a final plot twist. And Wilkie was the one who developed that.
Wow, from the mid-1800s. Mm-hmm. And it still kind of dictates like police procedurals and horror stories in this case.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and we don't actually see that term, you know, detective being used until Poe's murders at Rue Morgue, and that's in 1841. That's the first time we kind of see it as a title for someone rather than just that they are out detecting things.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or well, does the timeline overlap? When is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle writing Sherlock Holmes?
The first time we see Sherlock Holmes is in 1887.
Okay.
So that's the first time we see that. So it precedes it.
Much later. That's,
yeah.
I wouldn't have assumed that, like, even Sherlock Holmes is kind of building on a pre-established kind of formula as far as detective stories. They're just far more intricate, and Sherlock
absolutely
has to be written
and
as
a genius.
And
that's why I think you see Poe being the person who's kind of technically the modern-day detective.
Right.
And that's why he gets the credit for it, is because of his use of the word detective, and then the first time, and you have the twist ending.
Yeah.
It's everything you could hope for.
Yeah, Murder at the Rue Morgue. While I don't think I've ever read it, I guess I'm familiar enough to know the twist.
I know the twist. I've read it.
Yeah.
It's a good twist.
Is it?
I mean, I don't know. I think you have this specific kind of criminal and you start kind of getting this idea. Poe paints it a certain way because he's trying to mislead you as the reader, which is mean, not nice.
Poe, not nice.
Then you get Shyamalan'd even before Poe like knew what that was.
Yeah, I get so for other sort of modern movies or stories that stood out, I was thinking From Hell is an interesting one in that same era. It's kind of Jack the Ripper meets Sherlock, sort of. But yeah, I don't really like that movie, so I wasn't really drawn to
that. That what's his face's accent was good. I remember
Johnny Depp,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's his face? Whatever the. I thought his accent was good. I remember that much, and that's about as far as that goes.
Yeah, other stories. Wolf Cop. I've really enjoyed that.
There is a cop story for sure.
Comedy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a horror comedy. Yeah.
In 30 Days of Night, Sheriff Olson is whatever one of the main characters. We've got. Lieutenant Donald Thompson from A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes, who, everyone's dad.
Yeah,
everyone's favorite dad.
Yeah, that was – it was perfection with the final New Nightmare book ending and and bringing back John Saxon. He's America's favorite dad.
Yeah.
More recently, there was Last Shift, which I liked quite a bit. Kind of blended together in my mind a little bit with Let Us Pray. Did you see either of those?
Those movies are all the same to me. I don't think of them.
UK cop horror. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was Baskin was, I don't know where those guys are, but that was a pretty hardcore movie. I guess it was in my subconscious because the opening sort of formatting it as an episode of Cops, I was actually thinking of the X-Cops episode of The X-Files.
Yes.
That's a really great piece of television.
And do you remember there was a TV show? It was very short-lived. It was on MTV when they were having scripted TV shows, and they were fighting monsters and shit. I love that. That was so funny.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of that, but I remember you mentioning that not having heard anything about it. And I was like, I think you just dreamt the thing and then shared it with me. But
no, it was real and it had like 5 episodes, but then gone.
Yeah. That would have been a weird one to like, if that was still going now, like, I don't know. It's kind of a weird moment in time. But no, the movies we're here to talk about are some old and new. One I kind of hope grows into a classic, but we're talking about Deliver Us from Evil from 2014, Maniac Cop a little bit. That's getting remade this year, which
No.
Why the fuck? Like, no. Is it Maniac Cop? What? Because he came to his senses. I don't know. That's mean. but the last movie we're doing is Fallen from, I think, 98 with Denzel Washington and a huge cast. I've been talking about this one. I'm trying to think of a comparable one. A movie that I've been talking about for forever. Well, no, Get Out this year. Well, it took you a little while. Like, I was really adamant about it, and you're just like, it can't possibly be that good.
I've actually seen this movie before.
Had you?
And I remembered when the singing started, and I go, oh, I've seen this. And I knew the ending, but I didn't remember what happened at all in the middle, so it was all brand new to me as I was watching it.
Okay.
But yes, I had definitely seen it before. It just went out of my mind.
I'm surprised you forgot it. Maybe you watched in the context of other cop horror movies. I'm looking at Hot Fuzz is the last one on my list of just like great honorable mentions. Not really a horror movie, though.
No.
It kind of, I mean, it sort of frames itself, and there's lots of references to like Wicker Man and even share some of the cast, but I don't think of it as a horror movie. There's some good gore in it, but I'd say it's like borderline, but in any case, Edgar Wright always deserves a mention. But we're gonna start off with a new one to both of us. This one somehow slipped by.
How did I miss this one?
2014's Deliver Us from Evil, not to be confused about the documentary about the molesting priest who
which
has bounced
is
around
very
different
good documentary
parishes. Yeah, I saw
that's a disturbing documentary.
Yeah, that's a bummer. That really tells a story that like everybody's kind of familiar with through the news, but then like you hear the accounts and the personal. Yeah, it gets pretty dark. The movie we're talking about is far less good, which is surprising because it's got some great people associated with it. And I guess I'll just jump out there. I don't know. But, before we do, first looks, Mindy, what'd you think?
So I kept thinking, Because I watched Deliver Us from Evil and Maniac Cop on the same day in the middle of the day, which is very weird for me to watch horror in the middle of the day.
Yeah, and Deliver Us from Evil is a lot of
something I do at night.
Okay.
So I watched it in the middle of the day, and so I was thinking, oh, maybe that's why I did not like it. But then I thought on it, and then I rewatched certain scenes, and I go, no, I just didn't like it.
No, the movie's why I didn't like it.
Yeah. I will tell you one thing I did kind of like was Eric Bana's accent.
Really?
I thought it was really, like, in some words, really good. And then in some words, not so much. I thought Olivia Munn's accent was terrible. It was probably the worst thing I've ever heard.
Really? I must not have an ear for this thing because I – okay. So it's pretty rare that New Yorkers of what his age is presumed to be, late 30s probably, it's pretty rare that you encounter someone who sounds like – authentically one neighborhood. And for him, starting from, like, I like Eric Bana a lot, but he's an Australian actor who is really putting it all into that one accent, and it's sometimes it sounds almost Boston-like.
Yes, very Boston. Ooh. At the beginning, it's very, very Boston. He was really trying really hard. And then you have Olivia Munn do this, like, soft kind of Queensy thing.
Maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention to her accent, but I liked her portrayal overall. Like, they didn't give her a lot to do.
Nothing to do.
So the reason I expected to like this a hell of a lot more is because it's from the creator of Sinister and, well, other great things amongst them. But Scott Derrickson wrote and directed this movie. He started back in the day with Hellraiser Inferno from 2000. Oh, he did The Exorcism of Emily Rose, which I liked most of.
Yeah, it was okay.
And I really like Marvel's Doctor Strange, which Erickson wrote and directed also. And, like, that's a good one. That's one of the better Marvel movies. And I don't know where this one falls. You know what? This falls short in trying to sort of cram the book that this is based on into a film. And not much made that transition. That said, I've read about the book. And we're probably better off for it.
Yeah, the only thing that really, I think, goes with the book is the beginning of walking into people's houses of filth. And then it goes filth on this crazy tangent. One thing I thought, though, every time they come into one of these, like, filthy, filthy homes, did you notice that people own the whole home?
Yeah.
But, like, they're in an entire brownstone.
Yeah.
What? No one does that. And even when they're not, there's one filthy apartment, but that apartment is huge. It's like four apartments put together.
Yeah. Yeah, that is...
Who's living in these brownstones?
If they're... Well, were they... I guess some... No, I guess the one that we do see is a brownstone. Yeah. That is a strange...
With a basement and everything that's not rented out.
Yeah, no, the immigrant family who only sleeps in the living room. Okay, we're getting co-written by Paul Harris Boardman, based on the book by Ralph Sarchi and Lisa Collier-Cool, starring with the aforementioned Eric Bana, Joel McHale. That was a surprise.
That was a surprise.
Olivia Munn and Edgar Ramirez. Okay, so a brief synopsis. Wow, this is a studio synopsis, so, you know, buckle up. A 17-year NYPD veteran, Ralph Sarchi, works out of the 46th Precinct in New York's South Bronx. But it is his other job that he calls the work, investigating cases of demonic possession and assisting the exorcism of humanity's most ancient and most dangerous foes. Now he discloses for the first time his investigation into the incredible true crimes and inhuman evil that were never explained, solved, or understood except by Sarchi and his partner. There's more. Schooled.
I think Sarchi wrote this for himself.
Schooled in the rituals of exorcism and an eyewitness to the reality of demonic possession, Ralph Sarchi has documented a riveting chronicle of the inexplicable that gives a new shape to the shadows in the dark. That is a goddamn mouthful.
Yeah. And I guess not exactly everything that's going on in this movie.
No,
like,
I guess.
What, the work?
That's actually the synopsis for the book.
Oh, okay. I was like, we never are encountered by this ever.
No, so it turns out the movie, if I'm being generous, serves as a prequel to the book. Kinda.
You got a name?
Joe Mendoza. Just one of my charges.
One of your charges? What does that mean?
I'm a Jesuit priest.
Where's your collar, Padre?
I work undercover, like you. Can you tell me exactly how she was behaving when you first saw her at the zoo?
Like she was nuts? That's how?
When you arrested her, did she seem unusually strong?
No. Why?
The reason that would interest you. But if you do think of something more specific or if I can be of any help, please call me.
Edgar Ramirez plays, remember his name. Yeah.
Sexy pants.
Edgar Ramirez, did you think?
sort of. I think in a dirty way.
Man, that synopsis made me lose interest in this story. okay, so yeah, my first note is the dialogue was not very good.
No.
There are moments that are supposed to be the two partners talking shit and being familiar that read as false, and that's early. That's really early in the story.
It's the very beginning.
What's that?
What?
On your head. It's a hat. It's a Red Sox hat.
I love the Red Sox.
Fuck that. You didn't even watch baseball.
I love baseball.
Okay. Name me one play on the Red Sox.
Larry Bird.
Don't lie. You think that's funny? When a Yankee fan strings you up by the balls for wearing that hat, I'm going to be sitting there, I'm going to be laughing my ass off.
Oh, come on, Sarge. We both know you don't laugh.
I'd be laughing my fucking ass off.
6 Adam, respond to a 1052 violent dispute, 1459 East 183rd Street, apartment 2 King, Burnside to Grand Conk on the cross.
6 backup, Sergeant to Central K.
Go, Sergeant.
Run a name check on a 1052.
10-4, just a second.
What, you want a domestic call? Oh, shit, radar? You know when your radar goes off, you usually wind up with stitches?
You're an adrenaline junkie, and without my radar, you don't get your fix, okay?
You're right, and for that, I am grateful.
6 Special Ops, the name of the 1052 tenant is Jimmy Tradner.
Any warrants?
Tenant is 1019.
What? No warrants? Could Sarchi's radar be off tonight, ladies and gentlemen?
Do you show tenant occupation?
It says USMC.
Marine, I think you're still fighting the war. 6 Spec Ops, have Adam disregard. We'll take the call.
Hoorah!
Let's go.
So the story opens. You know what? I don't know if I appreciate it or because it doesn't work, I kind of resent it, that this is kind of framed like The Exorcist. Like, we start in the Middle East. In this case, it's in Iraq. We've got soldiers who follow enemies down a corridor that is fucking Lovecraft-esque. It is just a man-made ancient cavern that goes to who knows how deep, and in there they find a wall with writing on it, and then all shit breaks loose,
right.
And we lose the visual. We get that later in the story, but all we know are that 3 or 4 soldiers came back kind of haunted.
Right.
And wherever they go, they recreate the writing on the wall. So yeah, that's more of a movie synopsis for what we've got. Like, as far as the cops are concerned, that's what they're investigating. Graffiti.
Graffiti, yes.
Oh, and a lady threw her baby into the lion's den at the zoo.
And there's some sort of detectives, but we don't know actually what department they have anything to do with, because they're not homicide guys. Although they do go and check on a body. But then they go check on house calls. Like, nothing makes sense.
Yeah.
They're doing the job of, like, uniformed officers.
Yeah. I think maybe it's, I don't know, I'll take it as a sign of maturity that in my older years, I like a detective story that, like, demonstrates kind of a schlubby cop who looks like a cop, thinking like a cop, behaving like a cop. Here we've got Joel McHale and Eric Bana, who look like they should be in a Marvel movie.
Yes.
They are jacked
they're
to
huge.
The brim.
Joel McHale also a special expert in knife fighting. I don't think that's NYPD sanctioned knife fighting.
He had 2.
Yes!
He carries 2 knives for knife fighting.
Like, and he goes for his knives over his gun.
Yep.
Loves those
knives.
That's,
I don't think that's protocol.
No, I don't.
But, okay, so these two guys, they're in their unmarked car, and they... So Sarchi is regarded as radar because when calls go over the radio and he feels like That might escalate into a good one, and we can feed our adrenaline junkie status. Like, this is a conversation had in the car that, like, hey, for exposition, you guys get an F. Like, this is this sucks. But so he hears calls that he think might escalate and responds to those, where clearly, like, they're supposed to be, like, plain clothes detectives of some sort. I'm not sure what they detect.
They have
We're not sure if they're homicide.
For what just comes to them right away.
Right. Whatever they volunteer to do is what they get to do. And so, yeah, so a small case that's meant to be a marital dispute, there's a domestic violence call, and they respond to that, and that's where the knives come out, and that's the first of the soldiers who's gone batty. I'm trying to remember. That guy, what, gets taken into custody at the same time they're bringing in a woman who – that's who threw her baby into the lions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Den at the Bronx Zoo. Right. Now, that
so
was
then,
cool.
Yeah, they find themselves at the Bronx Zoo. Firstly, one thing everyone needs to know, there's a lot of gross fingernail shit in this movie. It's gross. Knock it off. I got it the first time. Stop showing it to me. But the lady who throws her baby in the zoo, they're trying to, like, investigate this. And for some reason, Eric Bana doesn't like cats, which is just some ridiculous thing. And then these whatever. what they didn't realize as they were securing the zoo because all the power went out and suddenly the sun also went out is
that it's nighttime.
But it was – why is the lady in there at night?
Well, she stayed after hours. I'm remembering it now that – lady throws her baby into the pit and disappears.
Right.
And so now they've filtered out, I guess, most of the people who were attending the zoo, but they haven't come across her yet.
Right.
So she's loose in the zoo. She's digging in the dirt.
And they forget that the Undertaker is still working at the zoo. They totally forget a man dressed as the Undertaker, which they totally missed. And then they're like, who's that guy?
Oh, the other soldier who's he's painting up on the wall. Yeah, that was a weird move. It seems like the graffiti that they put up, what is it, like only like one person gets served by every instance of graffiti? Because we spend the rest of the movie coming across that wall writing being painted up or already painted up. So it's weird that like they're designing portals to hell and then just deciding it's like, nope, one at a time, one at a time.
I don't understand. Yeah, I think only one guy can do it or something.
Yeah. None of this is explained, which I think is a problem later in this story when it comes to detecting.
Yes.
Yikes.
So let's move on to this crazy family that he and Joel McHale find, the immigrant family.
Yeah.
That has nothing really to do with anything except for more graffiti. But let me talk about this, right? So their light bulbs burn out really quickly and their candles will not burn.
Yep.
And they're seeing crazy shit. And so my thought is oxygen deprivation.
That sounds like, well, would
because
it be?
Because your candles won't work.
Yeah,
you'll have trouble with your electricity and you'll have hallucinations.
But they weren't complete shut-ins. They didn't like have to untape the door to let in the cops. Did they report the smell? I don't remember what specifically they're responding to in that instance. Is it?
It's a smell.
It is a smell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they had some painting done in the basement.
Because they live in this house, a whole freaking house in New York.
Yeah.
It's got to cost, I mean, let's say it's still South Bronx, and let's say it's in not the greatest of neighborhoods there. That house is still going to cost at least $3 million with a basement.
Well, it's haunted. You spend a shit ton on light bulbs. There's added expenses that are factored in.
Use those swirly light bulbs. They don't burn out so quickly.
So in the basement, Starchy finds the writing and finds a dead body who seems to have been there way too long for the kind of decay he was experiencing. But
I liked it, actually. I liked that part.
There's demons at play, and it,
yeah,
he's there.
That was pretty gross, and I liked that part of it.
Yeah, yeah, that was good and creepy. Yeah, that's the thing. I think there are moments in this movie that work, but there isn't a coherent story that's really compelling enough and really, I don't know, gets you to care about anybody. It's just kind of, these are generic characters. Sarchi is the haunted cop who has like auditory hallucinations of hearing radio static and children laughing, which turns out to be, I mean, only kind of related to experience, but nothing to do with a haunting.
No.
He's just, yeah, I don't know. We need him to be something. Let's have him be cranky.
I walk through the sewer every night. I've seen some horrible things. Nothing that can't be explained by human nature.
So we're introduced to the priest, Father Mendoza, and all right, I guess one of my biggest issues is everybody's names in this story. And from what I understand, Father Mendoza was a real person, and Sarchi is certainly a real person. But Mendoza, all I hear is the Bane character from The Simpsons.
Damn, damn. McBain.
Yes?
I'm not going to make it.
Oh, stop talking crazy.
No. Just do one thing for me. Get Mendoza.
Mendoza!
But otherwise, we've got a character named Santino, who's our lead villain, who is less than ethnic, more on the albino-ish side.
Yeah, he's like a redhead.
Santino. When they do eventually get the demon to admit its name, it's Jungler.
Your name, demon.
What is it?
You didn't hear that?
My name is the Jungler.
You heard the voice? Is it giving you a name? What is it? What is it?
It says it's called
Jungler.
Jungler. You have been vanquished by the blood of Christ. And by the authority of that blood, I command you to depart this servant of God. This is Jungler. You know your peril is imminent.
Yes.
What?
What kind of name is that?
They could have just done a couple like word search and replace on the script and I might care more, but this feels like a joke on me.
It's so stupid, and I will tell you that Sarchi was friends with Ed and Lorraine Warren. And this kind of shit goes hand in hand with them. Stupid shit like Jungler is exactly what I'd fucking expect from them.
And also, I didn't really hear Jungler in that moment. I mean, we're jumping ahead.
I heard Juggler.
Yeah, me too.
And I was like, oh, maybe, like, I don't know. That's at least mystical or takes talent.
You know what? It speaks to my ear, maybe for accents as well. But like the number of time I need people to say their names, if it's a difficult name, it's embarrassing for me.
You'd be talking to the demon and be like, excuse me, I did not catch that. And he'd be like, Jungler. And I'd be like... The Juggler? Jungler, I said. Excuse me, I just need you to repeat that again.
And now I'm laughing in the face of a demon, and no one wins then. But yeah, so Mendoza, he's your young, smoking, drinking. So long as he's not doing heroin, he seems to be on top of things, like
yes,
he kind of talks about.
He does have a hard time with heroin. Should not do it.
He looks at Sarchi and decides that he's got within him the discernment of spirit. I needed to go back. That was another difficult phrase that I had to rewind and look at these subtitles
Excuse
for.
Excuse me, what?
Because even he's got the all-seeing eye. And I think Sarchi, the actual Sarchi, has talked about being in these frightening scenarios, and he gets like a front of the head headache in his temple when he feels evil. It's like a spidey sense. Oh. When he feels evil coming up, he knows it. It's his temple that throbs.
That's what happens when I eat ice cream too fast.
same.
And that is evil because I am lactose intolerant.
Okay, so the story, it ends on such a silly note, just as far as like, all right, well, you're a cop, you're a cranky cop, so we're going to do as we villains do, we're going to kidnap your family.
Yeah, because like a demon has nothing better to do than kidnap your family.
It seems pretty myopic for a demon that presumably has been around for thousands of years.
I would say this is a very low-level demon, though, because that name is stupid.
I think that's a fair observation.
Like, all the good ones, Azazel, everyone else,
Legion,
those were taken. You're down on the bottom rung. You get...
Well, you with the three balls.
Jungler.
Two on the nose. Jungler.
Whoever's running their demon Ellis Island, he was like, Juggler, and they're like, Jungler, it's good, go.
For a guy whose name is almost Juggler, he has trouble like dealing with more than one thing at a time. And so he is pulled into a proper police interrogation at the station. He's got it's almost like Let Us Pray in that he's got carving. I guess Led of Prey was like barbed wire he kind of dressed himself with. But in this case, he's just got the wall carvings now on his chest.
Yeah, he's doing like a Book of Blood kind of thing.
You know what? They
which
never...
is a beautiful, always like, that's a, always a great image.
Yeah, it's
which,
disturbing.
Yes, give it to Clive Barker because that was like his kind of thing. But yeah. It's a cool looking image, right?
In theory, shouldn't it provoke somebody? Like, that should have been a moment where someone looks at that dude, sort of tries to read the Latin on his chest, and then that's the portal and someone becomes a demon, but that never happens. So the component that is exciting is that, like, we've got a police interrogation by way of an exorcism. That's actually one of the commercial moments. That was a trailer moment that they sold this movie.
I feel like Juggler should have asked for his lawyer.
Yeah, there were no lawyers 2,000 years ago or whenever he was last on Earth. That's juggling.
Juggling.
No, but I was excited that, like, we're going to have a combination of, like, the cop asking questions and the priest kind of being the, like, tough guy, like, you know, shouting power of Christ and whatnot. But it, no, they kind of, they
They're
do the old
doing
school.
This boring exorcism. It's,
give us your name,
it's
call
also
and response.
Very boring because it seems like there's no, it's just going to work no matter
there's
what.
No, there's,
it's like step one, read this. Step two, do this. Step three.
And then they do all those fucking things and. And then we get this. Actually, we never even see him divest the information. And interestingly, if this was the movie Fallen, then the guy would come out of his possessed state like it was a fugue state and not remember shit and not be able to tell them anything.
That would have sucked.
They never get the location out of the demon.
Mm-mm.
They exorcise the demon out, and now all we've got is this fucking Swedish guy who's got carvings all over his body, and he's very confused as to what he's doing there. But there's no suggestion that he would even know where the family was because the demon was at the wheel.
But he does, thank God for Olivia Wilde and whatever. Or Olivia Munn. Is it Wilde? I don't know. Whichever Olivia that is.
Munn, yeah.
Munn, yeah. I don't know the difference.
This is, it's just, it's bringing it all back. I didn't like this movie.
It made me angry.
Yeah.
Actually.
Fuck. This,
it made me very angry. And, like, the only time I was pleasantly surprised was, number one, with Joel McHale. I was like, oh, Joel McHale. And then he started talking. And then I lost interest in that. And then the body exploding, that was great. And then constant perplexion of the knife fighting.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I kind of like that. Yeah, it happens again. And
at least that one was like, I don't know, that was kind of rough. That was, I don't know, had some amount of authenticity, but then it just fucks up and ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this was all, there weren't really any through lines. This was one that, like, I remember seeing the commercial, and I was like, oh, shit, that looks cool.
Yes, I do remember seeing that.
And then
that.
I watched the movie, and I was like, what?
That was not cool. It's like the opposite of cool. And it made me angry.
Ugh. So, yeah, the end screen tells us that Sarchi retired from the NYPD, and he and Father Mendoza are now Ghostbusters in New York.
Exactly. Good. Great.
Yeah. So, okay, this is a little bit from an article on TheWeek.com by Scott Meslow called The Real Story Behind Deliver Us from Evil. And so this is all quoted from the article. This is Sarchi starting off. The truth is that I like to help people, he explains in the book. As a committed Christian, I have a different mission, quote, well, colon, to bust the devil and his demons. He claims to carry a splinter of, quote, the true cross.
Sorry to interrupt you. That is an Ed and Lorraine Warren thing.
Do they give those out?
She has one. Mm-hmm. Okay. She has one in her basement of treasures.
Those are hard to come by. Oh, it's in the famous basement museum. Mm-hmm. Okay. And judging by the rest of the basement, it's just a fucking splinter on the dirty ground.
Of course.
But, okay, so the guy who carries a piece of the cross and is ghost-busting in New York, what does he say? He interrupts a story of demonic possession for a bizarre aside about a time when he arrested a, quote, human criminal with, quote, with a little persuasion from his 9mm semi-automatic. That sounds like inappropriate police behavior. And when it comes to demonology, he's rigidly anti-science. Hello, Warrens.
Yeah.
Objecting to any so-called parapsychologists who approach hauntings with, quote, their cameras and Gauss meters instead of holy water and relics.
You know, why not fight made-up things with more made-up things? You know, don't use science.
I guess that's why the story, like, that's why the movie serves as a prequel, because if a cop was moonlighting doing this shit. That would be major cause for concern.
Yes. It is a good thing he retired.
Yeah, so that's that's Deliver Us From Evil. I thought it was going to be good. I swear to God, I was excited about it. I even got a recommendation from an old coworker of ours, Sam. Sam, if you're listening to this, you're wrong. Deliver Us From Evil is bad.
You know what? Sam sometimes recommends bad things. He watches bad things.
I'm boring myself. Let's move on.
To another movie that made me equally as angry.
This one we're going to breeze by because
it made me so angry.
I think back in the – I don't know what I like about this movie at all. You know what? I kind of like old, crappy, like crummy New York. The reference to Times Square and 42nd Street was one specifically about prostitutes.
It right. And to me, I've never had that experience.
Right. I guess by the time you get here, New York was cleaning up this act.
Yeah.
But my entire childhood coming into the city, it was always pretty grim. And Times Square, yeah, sex shops and all the like, and like, yeah, it was the Taxi Driver era, and 88, we were still in that, and Maniac Cop, I think, is it a sign of the times? I was actually pretty surprised that the cops talk about this one rogue cop as, like, this crazy anomaly. People used to love cops up to this point.
Yes, and they really... the history of Maniac Cop in the movie, as far as the history in the movie goes, everyone loves police officers except for Maniac Cop.
he's giving them a bad rap.
He is giving them a bad rap. And I thought to myself, like, 1988 was a crazy place.
There's someone out there.
Hey!
No one knows his name. No one knows his face.
Oh, no.
But now, the most terrifying man in the city.
Officer! Oh, thank God it's you.
Carries a badge. When a cop turns killer, you have the right to remain silent forever.
But yeah, there's also some great landmarks that show up in the film. Some of it was filmed in New York.
Oh, was it not all? I thought it was all.
No, that's why it looks like fucking L.A. And I find myself many times in my notes being like, where the fuck are we? Because this isn't New York. But you do see the bitter end kind of at the beginning. And that's, you know, still there. That's kind of cool to see those kind of signs. But no, directed by William Lustig, written by Larry Cohen.
Yeah, yeah. The Lustig having made the original Maniac, which... I don't know if we'll get around to covering that one specifically, but okay. Larry Cohen, prolific screenwriter, he wrote This Stuff, and yeah. It's Alive, and Phone Booth more recently, but yeah, he's always working, that guy. Starring Tom Atkins, who I've never understood his appeal. I don't want to be mean, but I'm puzzled
that he... You just don't get it.
Yeah, like I could see him in like Death of a Salesman. I looked it up. He was in his 50s when he made this movie, and they're still throwing him around. Yeah. I felt a little bad. But okay, so younger people we know, Bruce Campbell.
So I thought this can't be all bad.
Except he thinks it's pretty bad,
yeah,
if you ask
him.
We've got like extended cameos by Richard Roundtree, John Shaft himself. This is a cop horror episode. And the now past Robert Zadar as Maniac Cop. Robert Zadar is a familiar face. He's got an iconic jaw.
Right.
It's like a flat-edged shovel, that guy's jaw. Very big guy. But okay, the synopsis, if one needed one for this movie. It's called Maniac Cop. It's about a maniac cop.
The end.
A killer dressed in a police uniform begins murdering innocent people on the streets of New York City. Yeah, he's not even, like, he's just a sociopath in a police uniform.
Yes.
And the first time we see that in action is a woman who, like, successfully escapes her, I guess, rapists and her attackers or muggers.
I think they were just going to rob her. I don't know that we knew exactly what they were going to do.
She is so good defensively that, like, we don't even get to find out their intentions beyond assaulting this woman. And so, like, she makes pretty good work of them, but whatever, they still chase her into a playground. It does... kind of look like the Bronx, where she encounters like a mammoth police officer in the shadows, and then he responds by grabbing her by the neck and strangling her to death, which, whoa, curveball. pretty early on. Well, so Tom Atkins is shown the body by William Lustig's real-life doctor playing the mortician.
Who has a mullet?
I wrote mullet in my notes.
I was like, 1988 was a crazy time. Even doctors had mullets.
I wrote, I bet when no one's around, he gives mullet haircuts to all the dead bodies. It really was. That guy was a talking mullet. Yeah, at which point, like, we start getting long scenes of exclusive exposition, mm-hmm. which, considering we haven't cared yet, exposition is not the way to get us to care about characters.
Here's the problem with this movie. Not only is it bad, it is boring as hell.
Yeah.
It is the most boring movie.
When you texted me that, I was really nervous that you were talking about Fallen at first. And I was like, Fallen opens with a great intro.
No, I was talking about Maniac Cop.
I was worried.
It is so boring. And the deaths, even the strangulation, any of the deaths are just boring as hell too.
Yeah, all these movies are in the ballpark of 2 hours. And I'm going to say, with the exception of Fallen, they don't need to be.
No.
There was a lot that could have been cut. It's one of the things about, like, good writing and brevity. It takes a good writer to keep things short and have them work. It's kind of a lazy guy who spreads out, you know, a half an hour's worth of story into a 2-hour film, and that's what we got here.
It was terrible. Then there's this subplot. So Tom Atkins is, I don't know, being a police officer, doesn't matter. And then Bruce Campbell is going to get framed. Bruce Campbell's wife is the worst person ever. And in my notes, I literally wrote, I hope she gets killed. And then on the next line of notes, I wrote, yay! Because she did, and they're now framing Bruce Campbell for no reason. At all.
Well, he is very briefly our red herring, which seems like that might have been more interesting if they had built on that. But as soon as we introduce him as a red herring, we remove him as a red herring.
Right.
It doesn't last.
It's like the Shyamalan, it's the trees. No, it's not. Yes, it is.
Yeah, no, they are supervised by Captain Ripley, who tells us he's got 4 weeks before his retirement, because mm-hmm. you can't avoid that in a cop movie. I would love to stop talking about this movie. Are there any points, any highlights that you wanna talk about?
Well, here was just one of my notes. It's followed by a note that ends with, this is the worst scene ever. And then 2 lines later, it says, I hate this movie. and then it says, even the big face reveal is boring and lame. However, I apparently started to laugh and had some fun when I said, LOL, hiding behind the drapes. The giant, giant cop is hiding behind the drapes in one of the scenes, and you can see his fucking shoes.
No answers as to how in the hell he got in there.
Into the mayor's office.
Because
it
is the mayor's office. Yeah, that, okay.
Nothing makes sense. This movie's terrible. Don't watch it.
Yeah. No, it's kind of, someone watched John Carpenter's Halloween and was like, yeah, but what if he had a badge? Like, it's fucking stupid. Okay, so more interestingly, you've done some research on the history of police.
You know, we think of Rue Morgue being the modern day detective, but there's a great story that comes from 3rd century. It's written on Papyrus 967. So we have 59 pages that exist from this text. And on that is one of these stories, which is Susanna and the Elders, which later gets attributed to Daniel. It's just a fable originally on this 637.
Okay.
And what it is Susanna and the Elders, like one of our oldest, you know, judiciary kind of stories. She's taking a bath and these old guys are looking at her being naked and they're being creeps. And she's taking a bath in like a normal bathing place. She's not being weirdo. They are being weirdos. Then she goes to leave and then they say, we're going to say that you were cheating and with a guy in there. If you don't have sex with us right now. And Susanna's like, fuck that shit. You guys are really old and I'm not going to have sex with you. So then they're like, you're going to court, Missy. And they take her to court.
Okay.
And which is really just a sentencing because it's 3rd century.
And it's 3 old dudes and a lady.
Exactly. Exactly. So she's in court. She's getting ready to be put to death. And then this is where Daniel just shows up at the right time. Good for him. Good thing he's there. And he yells at the old men. Well, if you saw her, where was she? Where was she exactly with this guy? And each one told a different location.
Ah,
and that's how you knew they were lying.
The original interrogation.
And
they
then
didn't
Susanna
get their story
gets
straight.
To go for free. She gets to go, and the old men get put to death. Shyamalan, 3rd century.
Wow. They get put to death for lying about, well, I mean, it's a false account of a naked cheating lady. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So that's probably
still
like
seems
the
extreme,
first.
But I like the old split them up and get them to yeah. talk against each other's stories.
Yeah, that's... I thought that was really good police work by a fictional character named Daniel. The other kind of story that you think about as an early detective story is from 1001 Nights. It's one of those stories.
Okay.
So it was actually first written about in 947, but we know that it precedes it from oral history.
Wow.
And the way that 1001 Nights was told in the history of that. This is one called The Three Apples, which is really good. And everyone, I'm not going to tell you the spoiler because there's like double twist. Watch out.
Double twist spoiler to The Three Apples.
But the basic gist.
It was a pie.
It wasn't apples. They were oranges. Guy finds a suitcase in a river. Okay, here's the basic gist of the story. He finds this suitcase or this chest in the river, and he sells it to this other guy named Haroon. Haroon opens it and goes, oh my God, there's a body in here. He thought he was buying like treasure, but it was a body. And so now Haroon has this lackey buddy that hangs out with him, and Haroon orders his buddy to solve this mystery of who this dead lady is and who killed her in 3 days. Or else, well, Haroon's going to kill his friend who's going to solve this because I don't know why.
You have 3 days to solve this or I'll kill you.
Yes.
All right.
So Haroon's buddy doesn't solve it in 3 days because it's a cold case. Clearly, it's going to be in red on the board. Whatever. Two guys come forward and say that each of them, they say, I killed her.
Okay.
And they couldn't have both killed her. And so then they start arguing amongst each other like, oh, no, I killed her. No, like I killed her. Blah, blah, blah. And so then you have to read the story. Go online, find the story of the three apples. It's really, really fun. There's some Shyamalans in there.
From the 1900s, this story.
No. From the 900s.
What did I say?
1900s.
The 900s.
And we know that it preceded the 900s. It's the first time you ever hear the story of Scheherazade and the 1001 Nights. It written down is 947, but we know that it's previous to that.
Huh.
But definitely check it out. That is a great whodunit story.
Nice. So my assumption about older police stories, especially something from 900 AD, I'm surprised there isn't more, you know, sort of mystical components. There's not sort of, I mean, they hadn't discovered germs, for God's sake. So, like, there's still a very rudimentary level of detecting happening. And that's what appeals to me. As far as like, if there's anything from Deliver Us from Evil that I like, it's just kind of the overlapping of these worlds. These guys who are supposed to be detectives
mm-hmm.
are meant to work on evidence and sort of talk about procedure. We don't get any of that.
No.
We do, however, in Fallen from 1998.
Edgar Reese, who's you? It's the brilliant detective who sealed my brutish fate. Remember this, Hobbs? What goes around really goes around.
You have a safe trip, yeah?
It's on my side. Directed by Gregory Hoblit, who also directed the court. It's a court psychological drama, Primal Fear.
But also tons of Hill Street Blues.
Yeah. He was. He's done a ton of television, and it seems like he's kind of returned to television, having started with Hill Street Blues. He was one of founding creators of NYPD Blue and gave that its aesthetic. Dude's won a lot of Emmys. As far as like the feature, oh, that's funny. He did two episodes of Cop Rock. I don't know if you remember the musical cop show that existed briefly.
No, that
briefly.
Sounds stupid as hell.
It's on YouTube. oh no, it's not good. No, you're right. It's yes. But I think he actually helped create that show. Come to think of it, he mentioned on the commentary.
We'll just not mention it.
He also did Fracture, the fictionalized story of the Robert Durst
mm-hmm.
murder, and yeah. But so written by Nicholas Kazan, who, as well as being a screenwriter, is also a writer for the stage, starring Denzel Washington, a young, handsome, really, I get it.
Yes,
I totally get it.
I totally get it, too. And I feel when I was younger, I did not appreciate Denzel Washington as much as watching it this time. And I was like, yes, I get this.
Also starring John Goodman. This is such a good cast. This is one of my favorite casts in any cop movie or horror
Everyone's
movie.
Everyone's in it.
Yeah. John Goodman plays his, mm-hmm. his partner, Elias Koteas, in this movie. And The Prophecy, I fell in love with Elias Koteas, and he's I don't know that he's ever been as good as he is in this movie.
I thought he was Chris Maloney at first. And I was like, this is crazy, everyone's in this. And then I was like, I don't know who you are. And then I IMDb'd him, and I was like, every time I see this guy, I think he's Chris Maloney.
Aw, that's a bummer for him.
Like, I think they're the same person.
But yeah, Elias Koteas, he's in the first 5 minutes of this movie, and somehow he steals the show.
Yeah.
We've also got Donald Sutherland as their captain. We've got James Gandolfini as another detective. Mm-hmm. We've got M. Beth Davids, who is playing Greta Milano. She's a face you might recognize from Schindler's List.
Army of Darkness. Yeah, that's where I recognize her.
She was in Fracture by Hoblet. She was in Europa Report. I don't remember her specifically from Europa Report, but we did like that movie mm-hmm. a lot. So, brilliant cast. Really, like, tight story. Here's a brief synopsis. Homicide detective John Hobbs witnessed the execution of serial killer Edgar Reese. Soon after the execution, the killings start again, and they are very similar to Reese's style. All right, that's another IMDb synopsis I wasn't thrilled with, but...
I kind of like those. I think they're funny. They make me laugh.
Detective John Hobbs wants to uncover the truth.
What does Azazel mean? Now, my dictionary says that evil spirit of the wilderness...
Walk away, Mr. Hobbs.
But nothing in this world...
is on my side.
Can help him solve this case.
There are angels. Some of these angels were cast down, and a few of the fallen were punished by being deprived of form.
Come on, get out of here.
And each touch.
And at the execution, did he try and touch you?
Or... yeah, he did, actually.
Passes the soul of a killer into someone new.
Well, I believe what I see, and I'm still trying to get my mind around what I just saw.
Some things, pal, you shouldn't know.
Well, let's just jump into okay. there, because the movie opens big with the Rolling Stones cover of Time Is On My Side, mm-hmm. which, when I originally fell in love with this movie, I had such a difficult time tracking down that one song by
really?
The Stones. Yeah, I mean, these days, I mean, it was a long time ago by this
yeah,
point.
Yeah, but what did we have? Ubiquitous. We had Napster. You probably could have gotten like 5 million versions of it in 1998.
I was looking for a legitimate means, but... I think I probably did find
Napster
it on some file
Napster was legitimate
sharing.
In 1998. Thank you very much.
But yeah, so the brilliant creepiness of a death row inmate. Before the dead man walking moment, he demands to be met by the detective who put him away. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like a, you know, classic, you know, bad guy, good guy setup. And in this case, like, it's a controlled environment. So Denzel is kind of humoring him, and he shows yeah. up at the prison where he finds a documentary crew filming Koteas, because I guess he's, even amongst murderers, he's kind of an oddball.
Yeah, he's and, very popular.
Interesting enough for a documentary. To Denzel, he is so comfortable and almost happy and just enjoys the company. And you kind of, like, yeah, it's starting to sink in that, like, there's more than just a guy facing his death going on. And so when he reaches out and grabs Denzel's hand and kind of shakes it and starts muttering in Aramaic,
right.
now shit got real.
Right. But Denzel actually seems pretty cool. At the same time, he's just like, this guy's crazy.
He's
a
cucumber.
Joker.
Yeah. He's just, I don't know. I guess as far as Denzel's concerned, like, this is just the last chapter in this asshole's
right.
book, and I'm happy to read the last line. Like, he's, yeah.
Yeah, he's very cool about it.
Before Denzel, you know, excuses himself to leave because he's had enough of crazy, Koteas starts singing, Time
yeah.
Is On My Side. And for a death row inmate, probably about 10 minutes away from his last breath to
time
be singing.
Time is not on your side,
time
sir.
Is on, but it's such like a perfect... It's almost like if it was put in a movie now, I might feel like, well, this is kind of contrived and mm-hmm. kind of stupid. But at that point, like, between the acting and the tension built and the music, like, it works so well.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorite moments in one of my favorite movies.
Put the gun down!
On my side. Hey, pal.
So he's led to the electric chair, and we get to see what a gas chamber setup kind of is. I don't know if that was authentic. I have no idea. It didn't look very antiseptic and like surgical in an environment.
And there's a reason we don't do it anymore, because it's not good.
Yeah, and there is an audience watching the execution. Denzel's amongst them, and he's still fucking singing.
Yeah.
He spends his last breath singing, and then we kind of get, like, demon vision for the first time. And now we know, like, oh, this is where this story is going, because, you know, whoever was in there singing, Azazel, as it turns out, is now off to the races.
Right.
Like, he gets to pick a new form and start all over again. And so that's kind of the dynamic of that feeding into a very pragmatic detective trying to make heads or tails.
He's very cool, too, about everything.
Yeah, like, Denzel's always pretty calm. And he takes
everything in a really great stride.
Yeah.
Did you notice one of the first people that Azazel goes into, Charles, who quits his job and then goes on a murdering spree, is actor Robert Joy, who we just saw recently in Hills Have Eyes as the guy with the cleft palate.
Yeah, that character actor who I feel like I've seen in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, he's one of those guys.
Aside from the Hills Have Eyes, none of which come to mind, but like you definitely recognize him. And he's an odd guy, and he certainly like works with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do appreciate that, like, all the actors who Azazel is embodying do inherit this swagger.
Yeah.
Like, they are, you know, they all kind of let each other's performance inform their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really cool. So when the murders start popping up, and it kind of seems like the pattern is dead guy in bathtub, and then a
cereal and milk.
Yeah, kitchen set up for
if
breakfast.
If he came in here, he would be screwed. There is no cereal. There is no milk.
There's no table.
Yeah, there's no table. He would have to get a Cliff Bar and get it, put it on the white trash table here, which is where I eat in front of my TV.
Yeah, and the serum that he uses to poison is consistent with what Reese did.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start wondering, is there an accomplice that we never caught up to who was always on the outside? They speculate
copycat.
Whether it's a cop or a copycat.
Mm-hmm.
And like who would have these specific details, and that you know, understandably leaves a cop stuck.
And then we're kind of with this red herring because Lou, James Gandolfini, is shady shade.
If only for his mustache. But considering this is, well, I guess Atkins had a mustache. But it's just, yeah, I don't know. For
cops have
for
mustaches.
Three cop movies to arrive at the James Gandolfini mustache as being like the, you know, what, he earns it. It's such, yeah, it's a real mustache. It works. That mustache is a detective in its own right. but yeah, Tony Soprano himself, who like I think True Romance was another one that he stood out as you know, being a great character actor. But before Tony Soprano, people wouldn't necessarily recognize him. And he's good in this.
He's
kind
really
of
good.
The new guy to the station, so he's not ingratiated. They kind of treat him like
an asshole,
asshole because
though.
He is an asshole.
Yeah, he's an asshole.
So, Hobbsy, tell me something.
Shoot.
The other day you were down in the basement reading an old file.
Yeah, what about it?
Well, it looked like there was some kind of map in there. I was wondering, you go somewhere?
Yeah, I went up the country.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great to get out of town. Huh?
Lovely, fresh air.
I used to do that, go up to a house and mountains and sit by the water. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, where'd you go?
Why you ask, though?
Come here. Time is on my side. Yes, it is.
There's a lot of didgeridoo on the soundtrack. Did you notice all the didgeridoo?
Why
so much didgeridoo?
I don't have an answer for that. So the score was done by Dun Tan, who won the Oscar for his score for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But yeah, the music moves between like exclusively like strings and like
mm-hmm.
the sort of these really lovely background pieces, and then the demon vision gets its own score, and that's
it's mostly didgeridoo. Mostly didgeridoo.
And there are also like textures and effects blended in there as well. Yeah, I liked it. Between the cinematography, like I really feel like there is a singular vision where the other movies were just kind of like hodgepodges of scenes and moments. Like this is cohesive. Like this is a well thought out and well produced feature with, you know, the cinematography by Thomas Siegel. It's very warm. There's so very amber, a lot of earth tones.
Very warm and very like earthy, and probably that's the didgeridoo. I mean, it all makes sense with this, I suppose. I also like how it's all tied together with a voiceover by Denzel. And it's one of those, I bet you're wondering how I got in this position kind of things. But it actually doesn't seem silly when he does it.
No.
You know, you just go along with the ride.
Yeah, because I think the commentary, so it's very crime noir. And like there is a genre that likes to sort of sprinkle in the horror components. But in this case, the voiceover of the detective being a cool, calm cucumber explaining, like, what you're seeing is me flailing and running out, like barely able to stay on all fours. But the narrator is calm as fuck. Like,
right.
Denzel is, like we said, cool as a cucumber. And then we're into the story. And we get little moments here and there. There's not too much voiceover. It doesn't become like
Blade occasionally
Runner.
Happens and you're like, okay, I can live with this. It's not cheesy or weird.
Denzel's brother, Art, is played by Gabriel Cassius, who in the story, he's father to little Sam and seemingly suffers from a cognitive impairment of some sort. It's subtle enough. It seems like they allude to his wife having left, and so Denzel seemingly takes in his brother and his nephew,
right.
And then Denzel's marriage seemingly falls apart under that stress, and so now we've got two brothers raising a kid, and it works. Like, their dynamic is like
it's
comfortable,
a nice
familiar
story.
One.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
I will say, if you're ever in any situation, his nephew Sam, you want that kid on your team.
Yeah,
kid is down.
He's quick to pick up
anything. No questions. You want to shoot a cop? Fine. You want to punch somebody? Go ahead. Sam's with you. He don't care. You want to live in a hobo hangout for a while?
He doesn't
Sam
watch
goes
Denzel
with you.
Shoot a cop.
Oh no, he watches him punch
all
a cop.
All the other stuff though. Yeah, no. You want to assault a cop? Cool.
Yeah, cool. Let's go. You want to live this hobo hangout area? That's cool too, Uncle John.
Yeah, he was good under pressure. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting that they didn't make him Denzel's son.
But you know what's
but
weird, though?
I like that more.
With all of that, you know, he's down for anything except for smoking.
he really absorbed those lessons, it seems.
Punch a cop, fine, but don't smoke cigarettes.
Or maybe
Uncle
the
John.
Lesson he learned is do as I say, not as I do. Well, for the best. I do love it because it like Deliver Us from Evil, it is this cross section of detective work and demonology. You know, detectives look for suspects. If a lead or a clue leads to a suspect, they'll run the name looking for a record, acquaintances, or their residence. Mm-hmm. That name is power. And in The Exorcist and movies about demonic possession, there's often a big fuss made over the demon's name holding certain power and how part of the exorcisms are usually about revealing that name or throwing that name back at the demon, it seems. And in this case, when at the cabin, he does come upon the name Azazel. He doesn't know what it is, but we are in the early days of the internet, and he does get down to some pre-Google. I think web crawler is his search engine of choice.
Yeah, and that also I made a note about that. I was like, because at the very beginning, he's also doing some early internet searching, and it's just adorable.
Yeah, he's chasing down the riddle that Reese gives him initially and starts appearing at the crime scenes. Yeah, yeah. So as much as he can find is that Azazel is regarded as a spirit of the wilderness, which seems like that is a very web response.
Yeah, I mean
the good stuff is in the old texts. We find that out,
right? Yeah, because Azazel, that doesn't. The internet in 1998 was terrible, apparently. Because I did like one quick search, I found all sorts of shit about Azazel.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh, I guess
he's a goat man.
Yeah, things have changed.
Yeah,
he's one of those.
He's actually probably that original scapegoat. You know, they would let one goat go into the wilderness. That was Azazel. So he's depicted as a half man, kind of half goat guy.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Denzel Search, and I guess this is sort of the combining of characters. I think it was originally meant to be two characters between the detective who the clue led him to, and that's whose cabin he was in, and then tracking down that daughter, and then someone who can inform on the spiritual stuff. So they, in the story, they sort of combined it and said that the child of the detective who died mysteriously knew just enough to be afraid, but continued exploring and is now mm-hmm. like a theologian.
Yeah.
So she knows Azazel. She knows the word, and like she's, you know, in 1997 is when this would have been made. Like, she's the one with the books. She's got the full story on Azazel, and she breaks it down for him.
So you're saying that Edgar Reese is actually...
At the time you knew him, he was not himself.
He was Azazel.
Yes, Azazel. Sadistic, left-handed, likes to sing.
Reese?
Yes.
So why does he focus in on me? What you doing?
You got his attention. So he tried to get inside you. Remember, he shook your hand. That didn't work. So now he's going to try and find some other way.
My favorite, and I think one could objectively say the best scene in the movie, at this point, we sort of seeded the idea that the murderer, Luce, mm-hmm. is either a former accomplice, but it might also be a detective familiar with the case mm-hmm. and be this copycat killer. That idea has been seeded, I think, two different times in the story up to this point. And so when James Gandolfini draws Denzel in and starts singing to him, "Time is on my side," in his ear with this devious look on his face. And then it becomes a fucking sing-along with the touch of a shoulder.
It's so cool.
It's my favorite thing in the movie. And so Denzel is watching his precinct one at a time. It's almost like a flash mob, mm-hmm. like for Denzel in terms of, like, you know, taking the last lyric that the person before you did and continuing the song upon the touch of your shoulder. And Denzel is like following these people around this precinct. People like Ido Totoro, who, like, you know, they've known each other forever.
Right.
And that leads him outside, because at this point, like, we've got everybody in the precinct at some point has sung the song. And when he follows someone who gave him the evil eye on their way out of the precinct, mm-hmm. and now he's in the street, and now it's a crowded street and people are touching each other's shoulders.
Yes.
And everyone's got a message for him. That, like, it made the hairs on my neck stand up. It's so
great.
Good.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
And each actor in it is directed so well, even if it's just for the one passing second that they don't even have a line. They are so creepy the way that they're staring at Denzel.
Yeah. Yeah. They use a lot of dancers in those setups. People who were comfortable with, you know, the choreography mm-hmm. of coming and going and passing. And yeah, everyone, like, it, I feel like it's even creepier outside of the precinct, because the conversation kind of becomes one of confrontation, where Denzel right. sort of throws his name at him and it's like, "I'm on to you. I got your name. I don't know what's next, but I got your name."
Right. Well, and there's another great chase scene that uses that similar idea, where they're chasing someone down the street later on in the film, and each person's touching the person in front of them, and Azazel's moving forward with this crazy amount of speed.
Yeah.
And that also was so exciting. The body jumping was so good in this.
When they're chasing down Ms. Milano, and that escalates, and at that point, like, We sort of get the distinction. As far as Denzel's concerned, like, this is about, like, this torture of the one guy mm-hmm. he can't get, because for whatever reason, you know, Azazel's spirit doesn't have the capacity to inherit Denzel. I guess he's too good.
Yes. Similar to handsome. That shine in Deliver Us From Evil. There's some special something.
Yeah. So in this case, Denzel, like, it's about torturing Denzel. But Ms. Milano is like a mere mortal, and she better watch her ass. And she feels it. Like,
he can get whatever she has, like, whatever she knows, he can get from her.
Yeah. So these moments feel like, I don't know, in the other movies, even during a knife fight where we're watching Joel McHale go at it, like, I don't know, you're a guy who pulled two knives. Like, I'm pretty confident that you're going to make it out of this okay. Like, even in perilous moments, you either don't give a shit,
right?
Or
I laughed.
You're confident.
I thought that was
that, like,
funny.
I did too. Yeah, it's McHale. Like, for whatever, I don't know.
He's a funny guy.
As a Bronx cop, none of it worked. But here, I mean, it bears mention that this is a Philly story. And for Philadelphia to take center stage in movies that are usually about, like, you know, hard-boiled New York detectives, mm-hmm. like, I don't know. I like stepping out of it. Like, this has one part city, one part Philly, like, you know, downtown. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's great. We get some, like, Jersey Pine Barrens tossed in there for the cabin. But, yeah, all the corresponding visuals and atmosphere built, like, it all works. Like, you feel for these people. Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to keep rambling. Because
you love it. And you know what? It's a good movie. It is a good movie. I would recommend, out of these three, obviously, Fallen is your best.
And the Three Apples.
And Three Apples. Check out the story, because I really don't want to give it away, even though it's like a gazillion years old. You'll still be surprised by the ending.
Nice. Wash his hands. The seal is fake. So a while back, Miskatonic Musings did the whole episode, and if you're familiar with their style, like, they do the sort of the beats, the story, and they go through mm-hmm. the entire thing, including spoilers and more jokes than you find here. So for those interested, I would recommend you check out the Miskatonic Musings episode on Fallen. But for us, we're going to wrap it up here. It kind of gets into spoiler territory if we go any further. Right. That said, like, I love the ending as much as I like anything else in the story. Well, the arm touching sing along is actually the best moment in the movie. But this is a movie with great moments.
Yeah, it's a good movie, start to finish. Denzel is easy on the eyes.
I got to stop talking about it, because I'll keep going.
So we'll close out here. We'll close out here. That was our cop. What did we call it? You had an alliteration for us.
Was it Cop Shock?
Oh yeah, it's not alliterate at all. Oh yeah. We're on all social media at Rance Macabre. Drop us a line. We do more Twitter than anything. We're terrible at Instagram.
Yeah. Our email is therancemacabre@gmail.com. Drop us a line there.
Tell us how you hate my negotiating skills. I don't care.
What else? You know what? I keep having to remind myself, we have merch. We have merch on our website.
We have merch.
Available for purchase. It's right next to the donate button, I think.
It's very cool, too, our merch.
Yeah, we've got stickers, magnets, and buttons. Drop us a line, or you could order directly from the website. We love to be in touch, so get at us.
Also, while you're checking us out online, check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/rancemacabre.
Yeah.
We always have extra, sometimes episodes, little addendums to each episode. And for this particular episode, we're going to have an addition where we talk about some true story, Cop Shock.
Yeah, no, there'll be, if I can pull it off, there'll be a sketch and some pretty creepy stories of police behavior, police in quotes, police behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a whole catalog of alternate material waiting for you on patreon.com. So give us a look. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.